So welcome to our new semester of Chassidus and psychology. In this chabur we go and we really like examine different phenomena in psychology, treatment methodologies, disorders, ideas, and then compare, contrast them with some of the ideas found in Hasidic philosophy. Hasidic philosophy from all over different corners and different schools of thought. So this week we decided we're going to launch this off. I had the idea. I went to a great conference, the Nefesh Conference, the Orthodox Mental Health Professionals Conference over the first week in December, in January, right on the break. It was a lot of fun. So a lot of colleagues told about a bunch of people about the our chabur. They were very excited. Shared some of the extra handouts that I had in my computer bag, and they were very, very excited. So we're making waves over here. I wanted to focus a little bit on the concept again of dialectical behavior therapy. We spoke about it a little bit 2 months ago, but I wanted to hone in a little bit more. Dialectical behavioral therapy was founded by Marshall Linehan in a way to try to treat borderline personality disorder, although a lot of the skills and the tools that she teaches that are used are good for anybody just in terms of promoting positive mental health and positive social skills. But this is specifically focused more towards the treatment of borderline personality disorder. Yes?
If I remember correctly, she had suffered with it when she was younger, and that's how she developed these methods, right?
That is correct. That after finding that nothing she could do would work, she started exploring, meditating, and found a treatment protocol that helped her and continues to help. It seems to be, if not totally, definitely a treatment of choice in treating borderline personality disorder. So first, we're going to launch in a little bit to understand some of borderline personality disorder. The first text in your packet is a text called DSM-5 Made Easy. It's a great book to aid for those who are studying diagnosis and studying the disorders in DSM, the DSM-5, the fifth edition. There have been many editions in between 4 and 5. You'd think 4 than 5, but no, there are a bunch of different updates and additions till 5 finally came out, and even 5 wasn't accepted across the boards. Depending on where you're working, what setting you're working, will dictate whether or not you're using 5, and are using 5 right now is not any statement politically about whether we think 5 is correct or not, but it's there, it's standard, and something that we can use to talk about it, whether or not all of the nuances of the DSM-5 we agree with or not. But since it's there and it's standard and it's here, it provides a good jumping off point. The DSM Made Easy series is a really wonderful series because it pares down that huge diagnostic manual, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages, and it also gives vignettes for you to be able to understand and unpack the disorders that are being discussed in a much more concrete way than just talking about symptoms without seeing exactly how these symptoms would make an impact into a person's life. So for that, it's a great resource. One of my professors in graduate school, when she taught the assessment course, said that I had taken it on a different campus, but she said that she always uses the DSM Made Easy series because it just does that in a very, very engaging, gripping type way. I mean, imagine sitting there reading an encyclopedia or a dictionary of disorders. not so interesting. It's a lot more interesting to when you can put a story to the disorder. So the code is 301.83, borderline personality disorder. And he says that throughout their adult lives, people with borderline personality disorder appear unstable. They're often at the crisis point between mood, behavior, or interpersonal relationships. Many feel empty or bored. They attach themselves strongly to others, then become intensely angry or hostile when they believe they're being ignored or mistreated to those they depend on. That's something that I've noticed. Any time out of the blue, someone really, really, really intensely likes somebody out of the blue. They're my bestest friend in the entire world. They are my soulmate. They are my this, and you met them for about 5 seconds. You know, so that should give you pause. Real relationships and attachments take time to build. So that's already a little bit of a giveaway. And in the same way that intense bonding, infatuation, attraction occurs, it also can flip over, you know, in the blink of an eye. And then immediately they feel spurned, they feel hurt. They may impulsively try to harm or mutilate themselves. These actions are expressions of anger, cries of help, or attempts to numb themselves to their emotional pain. Although patients with borderline personality disorder may experience brief psychotic episodes, these resolve so quickly they are seldom confused with psychoses like schizophrenia. Intense and rapid mood swings, impulsivity, unstable personality, interpersonal relationships make it difficult for the patients to achieve their full potential socially at work or in school. Right? They can be incredibly intelligent, they can be incredibly charismatic. But also that there's this piece there that they have this feeling and they connect to very strongly someone, and then when something destabilizes them, they will sometimes act out in all of these different ways. So he continues, the concept was devised around the middle of the 20th century. The patients were originally to hover between neuroses and psychosis, a borderline, whose existence was disputed by many clinicians. The concept evolved into a personality disorder that achieved remarkable popularity because so many patients could be shoehorned into its capacious definition. Although 1 to 2% of the population may legitimately qualify for a diagnosis of borderline personality disorder, it's probably applied to a far greater proportion of patients who seek mental health care. It may be still overdiagnosed conditions in the diagnostic manuals. Many of these patients have other disorders that are more readily treatable. Right? So what happens then, always, one has to be on the lookout for the differential diagnosis. Meaning that there are lots of different diagnoses that seem similar because some symptoms are similar, but when you slice it thinner, when you pay attention more, oftentimes you'll be able to rule out what seems to be, you know, different crossovers. Right, so in the little gray box, he says that oftentimes they'll feel empty and bored. Disturbed identity can lead them to attach strongly to others and then reject the same people with equal vigor. On the other hand, they may frantically try to avert desertion. Pronounced impulsiveness may lead them to harm, mutilate themselves, or engage in other potentially harmful behaviors, sexual indiscretions, spending sprees, eating binges, and reckless driving. Although stress can cause some type of dissociation paranoia, they quickly resolve. Intense, rapid mood swings may yield to anger that is inappropriate and uncontrolled. Okay, so that's a snapshot, right? A snapshot of the disorder that they find it difficult to self-regulate. The idea in the dialectical behavioral treatment, right, the idea of DBT, is to try to give them the skills to be able to manage this dysregulation, this emotional dysregulation, these strong emotions. These strong emotions are all-consuming. And as a result, they don't know how to compensate with it. As a result, the skills imparted by DBT are there to try to teach people suffering from this disorder how to navigate the very, very intense feelings that are accompanied by this disorder. So why is it dialectic? Dialectic, it's funny. Here at Yeshiva University, the Rav Zatzal used the term dialectic quite a bit. And it's always about the dialectic. The Rav is always talking about two. It's always one of two different things. It's always religious man versus halakhic man. Adam 1 versus Adam 2. Jews of fate versus Jews of destiny. It's always a dialectic, whether it's in philosophy, whether it's in Shas and Poskim. There's always a dialectic present. It's always one of these two things. So what DBT seeks to teach the patient is, similarly, this ability to see the dialectic, to have this dialectical reason. So if we start in the second line after the bold word, it says page 204, dialectical reasoning requires the individual to assume an active role, to let go of the logical reasoning and intellectual intellectual analysis is only a route to truth, and to embrace experiential knowledge. Meanings are generated and new relationships are found by opposing any term or proposition with its opposite or alternative. The primary message to be communicated to the patient is that concerning every subject, opposite statements are possible. Understanding that these feelings can often be all or nothing. This person loves you or they hate you. They're either great or they're suicidal. Life is a lot more multicolored than that. Why does it have to be this one or that one? Why can't it be both? Why can't it be both? There's like that meme. Why do I have to choose between this one or that one? It can't be both. Something like that. The dialectical therapist helps the patient achieve synthesis of oppositions rather than focusing on verifying either side of an oppositional argument. The therapist helps the patient move from either or to both and. Thus, many statements should be closely followed with their inherent opposites, with the therapist modeling for the patient the ambiguity and consistency that resided therein. The key is not to invalidate the first year or polarity by asserting the second. The position is also yes, but also, rather than yes, but no, I was mistaken. Yes, and. This ability to say yes, and is what creates part of the space for healing to happen. For example, when a person says, I feel sad. I feel sad. Now, everybody feels sad. It's part of our normal neurochemistry where we have our ups and downs. We have better good days, we have bad days. There are days where we get up and everything's running on time, the coffee is ready. You know, I made it to davening, I made it to my first class, everything's on time. I get, you know, I'm in class, I understand what's being said, I take notes, I go, I managed to get to class, I remembered all the assignments that needed to get done, I allotted the amount of time that needed to get it all done, I hung out with some friends, everything worked. And then I did what I wanted to do, watched a little bit maybe, and then went to sleep at a normal hour. And that's a day that sounds like it worked out pretty well. Then there are days that you get up late, right? Because last night you ended up falling down some rabbit hole of something and ended up binging 3 or 4 episodes or more and not getting enough sleep, and then kind of coming to not necessarily getting to davening, and then coming to my first class late, end up getting told off by a professor, why are you late, or why did you forget your assignment, or whatever. And then someone from the registrar is calling that there's a hold on your account. And then you go and your hat or yarmulke blows off in the Belfer wind tunnel and it starts to rain and you're cold and you're shaking, you're shivering, and you didn't hear understand what's being going on in Orgo recital. And then you come back and then you end up eating too much and then watching too much again, and the cycle repeats itself. Right? And both of these feelings are true and they happen. They're experiences, as they say, facts. You know that this happened. It was. But the difference is to say, okay, I had a bad day versus I am a bad day. This is bad. How's life? Bad. I had a bad day. You had a bad day? No, you had a difficult day. You had a tough day. You know, there were choices that I made that were not the best, but they were made. Of course, I was trying to self-soothe, you know, by finding soothing in food and finding soothing in watching something. I lost track of time. Two ideas are important here. The first is the possibility that personal and social change do not emerge.
Sorry, yes. Where are you reading?
On 205.
There's two pages in 205.
There's 204 and then 205. 205 again? Ah, the machines are after us again, huh?
So what section are we in?
Either which one. They're both...
They're both the same.
They're both the same, yeah. Oh. First, the possibilities for personal and social change do not emerge from some point outside or transcend the system, but lie within the existing contradictions of the specific context. The person and the environment both challenge and limit each other reciprocally. Change in both the person and their social context involves refinements and transformations of current capacities in light of these challenges and limits. The second idea, so number one, the first is that change is not coming from outside. I'm not looking for someone else to save me, or you're not looking for someone else to save you, but the change happens on the inside. The shift takes place inside of you. That's number one. Number two, the second is the extremes and rigid behavior patterns are signals that a dialectical has not been achieved. Thus, a middle path, they say similar advocated in Buddhism, but we know is also advocated in the Rambam. Exactly. The Rambam and the Ishbitzer and the middle place has not been achieved. Much like the Rambam, if you remember, says in his idea of in the Shemona Prakim, but also in Hilchos Deos, he says that anytime you see that there's some disorder happening, it's because that you're still not, you haven't achieved the balance, and that you're too full or out of balance. Anything to either which extreme is damaging. The important thing is to following the path of enlightenment to avoid being caught and entangled in any extreme, always to follow the middle way. The point holds for the therapist and patient. Thus, the therapist should not hold to flexibility in a rigid fashion or avoid extremes at all costs. As Robert Itkin said, a Zen master, we must be detached from our non-attachment. So what happens is that DBT is pulling us away from any type of extreme, even extreme in our non-extremeness, is our ability to say, okay, you find yourself being pulled to either which side. I feel bad. Well, maybe you feel good. I can feel bad and good. I can do both. That I can feel down, but if you remember when we spoke about ACT, the fact is that we're not fusing with that the feeling of feeling bad. We're not getting enmeshed with that feeling. So, okay, yes, I feel bad, and I'm going to go eat now. When we don't send that yes and, right, feeling the thought, noticing the thought, validating the thought, but also the and means that there's only one existence. There's only one thing in front of me. There's only one possibility. I feel bad, so everything's bad. But if I say yes and, there's another possibility. I feel bad, and there's free pizza. Right? That is free pizza, which is good. Which is good. I feel that the yes and, allows me to open up a possibility, especially for people who can only perceive, they only feel one thing, and very, very strongly. Once you open the door for something more, it gives them a way out to, on one hand, acknowledge the fact that they are feeling that, but at the same time, also give them room to for another possibility. So to the bottom of 205, one of the first and most important tasks with borderline patients is to get their attention. Entering the paradox is a powerful way to do just that. It works because the paradox contains with itself surprise, like humor. It presents the unexpected. When confronted with the paradox, one has to sit up and take notice. So he talks about this idea of koans, what are dilemmas and enigmatic stories that the students were given to solve. Even though there seem to be no logical answers, it gives makes the students go beyond their understanding to direct experiential knowledge. Knowing how sugar tastes by reading about it, its taste qualities in a book is very different than knowing how sugar tastes by directly experiencing it. The therapeutic strategy, the therapist highlights to the patient the paradoxical contradictions of the patient's own behavior, the therapeutic process and reality. So, jumping down to the words another on the page, next page, second paragraph. Another example has to do with a typical borderline patient's perennial dilemma of choosing who is right and who is wrong, whatever disagreement or confrontation arises. Right? Because if somebody's right, then the other person must be wrong. And I'm so right, there's no room for anybody else to be wrong, or right also. Yes.
With the checklist on the previous page, is
yes.
that for a patient to fill out to like rate their DBT therapist or it's kind of cut off, so I don't know what the source is.
Looks like it's from therapist to teacher.
Right, I believe I don't have it with me.
Saying it's referring to the therapist.
Right.
So.
No. I think it could just be a checklist of what the therapist is supposed to be doing in the session.
Just interesting.
Absolutely.
Lemonade or lemons.
So, the idea that the answer is either both or neither is difficult for the patient to grasp. Often, the therapeutic relationship is the first one the patient has ever been in where there is a confrontation, the other person asserts that I'm okay and you're okay. Right? So for a lot of these patients, again, that the immensity of the feeling does not allow for anything else to be there. Training them to be able to hold these two different positions at the same time, this dialectic. Right, finding along both lines, in Talmud, in Shas and Poskim, you know, any of the great great disputes, you know, is this a din in the Chefza or a din in the Gavra, as they would say, does this apply to the person, or is it an object oriented halacha, law? Is this a halachic functionality that permits something to be utilized? Or am I performing a mitzvah with this, as they call it, mitzvah or matir? There's lots of these different constructs in which we'll have two ideas, and that they're oftentimes set up as polar opposites. But the truth is that it's possible they could be both. Yes? All right, stretching. What? So that is the halacha based only on chafzer or only gavra? Maybe it's elements of both. For example, the idea of a talis katan, right? That's what we call tzitzis, right? So there's no actual bracha in Shas al mitzvah tzitzis. It's a later formulation, the mitzvah, the bracha of al mitzvah tzitzis. The idea of al mitzvah tzitzis would imply not that the person is obligated to wear tzitzis, that it would seem that the tzitzis is a chovas gavra, right? Sorry, it's a chovas cheftas. It's an obligation on the garment itself, not on the person. Whereas lihisatef b'tzitzis, to wrap oneself in tzitzis, that would imply on the person. So there are Soloveitchik in one of the Shirim Lezecha Avi Mori, I believe, that he talks about this possibility that could be why one makes a bracha on the talis katan, because it might be speaking to the fact that maybe there's the obligation of the garment, not the obligation of the person to put on the garment. So sometimes it could be normally the way that we see things that in terms of learning, maybe it's this one, maybe it's that one, or maybe it has properties of both, right? Maybe it's has properties of both. Alternatively, when we think of the how we observe the second day of Yom Tov in Israel. So what aspects of the day are we giving it? Is it that we just don't do work out of respect for the day? But what about the positive commandments? Like how much are we splitting the balance? So there are oftentimes they'll speak of different positions. They'll say you hold one day, you hold 2 days. Those are pretty normal positions. And then there's also one plus or two minus. One plus means that there's only one day, but we'll add the second day of Yom Tov.
Yeah, you don't do lotases or
ases. So we won't do we won't do lotases, but we won't do ases. And then the two minus, which is where we'll try to do some ases, but also get the other ases also. Like you might put on tefillin in private, but also here make kiddush. Because again, you're in between these two categories. So maybe it's one, maybe it's both. And this idea of maybe it's both, for a person whose understanding of everything is that there's only one way, right? There's only one feeling, and if that's your entire reality, of course you'll react, very very emphatically, because this is the only reality that there is. Right, so somebody's either they're my best friend in the world, or they were mortal enemies, right? Either I'm super happy, or I'm super empty, and there's no abatement from this. And then what happens is that by starting to be able to introduce the yes and yes, I feel sad, and there's free pizza. So then you're making room for more of it. He continues, or she continues, in particular, this is a crucial point. The therapist in DBT often validates the patient's point, but simultaneously does not give in or change his or her behavior. For example, in the strategy of observing limits, the therapist validates the patient's needs. Yes, it would be better for you if I were not going out of town this weekend, meanwhile continuing with plans of going out of town. So a person will get in part of what becomes difficult in treating a patient with a borderline personality disorder is that you'll tell them, I'm going away this weekend. You can't go away. What if I try to kill myself? I can't. I won't be able to handle it. And the therapist will say, yes, it might be easier for you if I didn't go away. But I'm going to go to Florida, and in case of emergencies, this is what we're going to do. And you can feel safe even without me. Which is not to say, don't be stupid. You didn't kill yourself yesterday. Don't kill yourself tomorrow either. Right? Or the alternative by saying, you're right. I can't go away. I have a suicidal patient that I have to deal with. Right? Both of those, right, either invalidating their opinion or invalidating yourself in both ways is not going to work, and is only going to strengthen the patient's the patient's symptom over there. But by teaching them that it's true that you might be sad, but we have other routines in place to take care of it. There are other ways to feel safe. That's the creation of the yes and. That's embracing the dialectic.
Sounds like it would be really challenging for the therapist themselves, though.
Treating a patient with borderline personality can be, but that.
You had experience with that?
A little bit. I have a bunch of colleagues who This is their specialty. So, you know.
How do you ensure the patient's getting the care that like they need to be without like totally be like how would you go away if you know they are suicidal?
So, another feature of DBT, and because DBT is a whole system, right, involves that you have several things. You have a lot of structuring and system put in place, because just in that way, a patient with borderline personality disorder doesn't understand boundaries. Hence the name borderline, right? They don't understand boundaries. So part of it is teaching them how to understand and accept and put into place boundaries. Also, what happens is that you have a number of people on the team working with, for the most part, in this protocol. So that you have a therapist who's talking to them, managing crisis, etc. Then you have another person who is a coach who's teaching them skills. Because otherwise, what will happen if you're taking more of a straight cognitive behavioral approach with them is that you won't ever get a chance to teach them skills, because it's always going to be about their crisis of the minute. Whereas in DBT, you have somebody whose job is to do skills, and the patient is then saying, you know, as much as they're going to try to, you know, talk about their issues, their life, and their problems, I'm sorry, but we're working on skills right now. Yeah, if there's a crisis, whatever, you can make an appointment with so-and-so to, yes.
Would that be more of a classroom setting usually, or still one-on-one?
It depends. Sometimes they'll do it in groups, and sometimes they'll do one-on-one.
Is that also so the therapist, like, he doesn't have to be as authoritative? Like, he can just, like a therapist can keep up the image of, like, he's handling with me. So that the coach will be kind of the bad cop, and the therapist will be kind of the good cop.
Right, I thought it was more that the coach would tell them how to practice with the therapist to form that healthy relationship.
Now. So, I mean, the coach is the ones who are doing the skills, running the skills groups, are the ones who are there just teaching the skills. Right? We're not here to process, we're not here to anything but just learn skills. Right? And the other therapist can do the processing processing and conversation and crisis, all of that. And then there are also certain other protocols for crisis, right? And there are also certain times where the therapist is and isn't reachable. Again, allowing the patient to learn those boundaries, those skills. You know, never in a situation that's going to put the patient in danger. But in an event of emergency, this is what you're going to do. Right.
Are the roles of the coach and therapist sometimes interchangeable? Like, if you're trained, would you learn how to do both?
No, your person's trained to do all of it. The person who's doing skills is doing skills.
Right, I'm saying, like, could a therapist for one person be the coach for another person?
Yes. And oftentimes these protocols are sometimes even used in inpatient facilities or semi-inpatient facilities. Day residents, you know, all types of different.
Do nurses tend to get trained with this kind of, like, in case somebody comes into the ER with a situation like this, are they usually trained to learn how to have some of these methods to try to work on it usually?
Not typical nurses. Maybe psychiatric nurses might have some, depending on what the protocols of the hospital are. Usually what you'll have is that you'll have specific groups, specific, like, DBT groups and DBT practices, the DBT fellowships that are working, and the system is set up. You know, the whole book of protocols is like this thick, you know, by yay big. The workbook is sufficiently smaller, but the theory behind it, you know, is a very large book. So by being able to enter these obstacles, by being able to enter this paradox, allows us to, number one, have this room to, you know, to wiggle between these intense feelings. So if we look at it, we'll do the central paradox, and then a paradox on page 208, and then we will jump over into into this other realm of Chassidus. A central paradox of DBT in all therapies is that all behavior is good, yet the patient is in therapy to change bad behavior. DBT stresses validation of a patient's responses, but only to counter the invalidation she's been exposed to. Validation is a strategic necessity. So long as the patient is mired in validation or invalidation, she cannot see that the dichotomy itself is an artificial one. Behavior is neither valid or invalid, neither good nor bad. Once the balance is achieved, both therapist and patient must move to a position of either validation or invalidation. Responses simply are. They arise as a consequence of causes and conditions that are both past and immediate. They're both internal and external. Internal responses have consequences which may be desired or not. Right? By labeling something good or bad, this is good, this is bad. That's not what... So if it's bad, so then I'm bad. And you get into entire... tailspin about it. The paradox of change versus acceptance runs throughout the therapy. Entering the paradox, the therapist highlights and amplifies the seeming incongruity that even the ability to accept that must be accepted. As we say to the patients, don't judge judging. A patient is exhorted to accept herself just as she is in the moment. But of course, if she does that, she will have changed substantially. The very admonition to learn to accept conveys a non-acceptance of the status quo. The patient is told that she is perfect, yet as she is, neither good nor bad, completely understandable, yet she must change her behavioral patterns. In this way, the therapist heightens the natural arising dialectical tensions facing the patient, so she has no other way out than to move away from the extremes. Right? So she's learning, that they're learning in that way to be able to accept the situation just where as it is. Now, acceptance doesn't mean, by the way, that I have to like it. It just means that it is. If you're so busy fighting with reality, you have no strength to do anything else. If you have so much, you burn so much energy fighting what is, you have no room for anything else. Once acceptance takes place, I'm sure I shared this with you before, Shea Linehan says, acceptance is the only way out of hell. Pain becomes suffering without acceptance. Acceptance is the only way out. Because once we accept that this is, right, I might not desire it, I might not want it, but this situation is, from thence change can emerge.
Who said that?
Marshall Linehan. I don't have to accept, I don't have to enjoy what is. I don't have to like what is. I just have to understand that it is. Once I've accepted it, then change can happen. And it's very funny because that specific piece of the inability to accept is sort of what characterizes the patient with borderline personality disorder. And that inability to accept, so just say everything's great, we accept it as it is, that itself is a major change. Yes?
How therapists teach people or clients to learn to accept the pain in a situation. Let's assume that someone had a car accident.
Right.
And he or relative is paralyzed now. So how can I accept the pain and move on? I deserve this pain, and like, okay, I accept and move on. Or like,
so that's not deserved.
How do you accept the pain?
It's not that I deserve it. It's just that it is. Right? Person's intraction, God forbid, no amount of cursing, kicking, screaming is going to get you out of traction. A person's ankle is broken. No amount of rage is going to change the fact that those bones are broken. Do you have to be happy about it? Nobody said anything about being happy about it. The key is only that it is a fact. This is a fact. My ankle is broken. If I stop wasting my energy fighting with the fact that my ankle is broken, pretending like it's not broken, trying to walk on it, and I realize this ankle is broken, I'm going to need to figure out what to do next, as opposed to staying stuck in the outrage that my ankle is broken.
I think in this situation, the thing is annoying is that you get the question constantly in your mind on why my ankle is broken,
mm-hmm.
why I'm in pain. So how do you try to get rid of these questions in your mind? Like, why am I in pain? Why?
Right, so in the realm of DBT, part of it is just a fact. We're not as concerned with why did it happen. It's more just understanding that it is. Well, what do I know? It could have been a consequence of me, me trying to show off while I was ice skating. That was a consequence. Anything else than that, I have no idea. But at the end of the day, the when I focus most on accepting the fact, it takes some of the, not the pain away, but the suffering away, right? Because yes, it hurts. Yes, the ankle is broken. Yes, I slept and it's broken. No amount of fighting with myself is going to change that. That is what it is. So if we look, onto the next page, I guess it would be one after 209. I had put, what's it called, on it, page numbers on it, but the Adobe was not cooperating today. It says validation. Validation does not mean that you agree or disagree or approve of the behavior. In fact, validation is non-judgment. And in this way, it's talking about whether a situation or, for that matter, somebody whom you're disagreeing with. So we focus on the inherent worth of the person. We observe, listen carefully to what's said with words, expression, and body. If it's we're validating ourselves, we honor our experience by sitting quietly with it, knowing it for at least a few moments. If you're validating someone else, use good eye contact, mindful and focus. So then you can describe in your mind what's happening, non-judgmentally. No, there is pain. It's radiating from my ankle. State the unstated. The presence of feelings that have not been voiced. You seem to be angry, also hurt by what that person said. If you're validating yourself, identify primary emotions. If anger is obvious, explore your feelings of any shame, hurt, disappointment may be hiding underneath. Understanding that this is what is, right? Understanding the experience that I'm having, I don't have to love the experience. I don't even have to, say that I'm thrilled with the experience. I'm just explaining what is. By explaining what is, that takes a lot of the emotional trigger off of it. Yes, I'm uncomfortable. Yes, this is painful. Yes, I feel embarrassed. Yes, I'm scared. That in itself, without becoming defensive, without describing more and more, judging what I'm experiencing, that changes the experience. And that allows us to hold more than one perspective at once. That introduces us to the perspective of more than once. It's not a huge amount of time. So I just wanted to look over here for a moment. We're glimpsing now in the world of Rav Aaron Halevi Horowitz of Streshelyer. He was one of the students of the author of the Sefer Tanya, also known as the Alter Rebbe, the Baal Tanya, right? So he was a Talmud of the Baal Tanya. Ultimately, he started doing his own thing towards the end of the Tanya's life, and definitely after his passing. And his writings are very, very similar to those of the Tanya, but with a little bit more in different directions, a little bit more descriptive of the person's day-to-day life. Oftentimes the Tanya's teachings are very, very highfalutin, if you will. They're very, very abstract, and I find that in the teachings of the of Rav Aaron Halevi, his words are very, very down to earth, also very, very abstract, but also he brings it down very much to our world as well. If you notice on this first Hebrew page, you'll see there's one word in a box, right? And you see it several times. It's the word Pella. It's a wonder. The idea of Pella is a wonder. Right? It's wondrous. What's wondrous? So every day there's a bracha that we make of Elokai Neshama Shenasata Li B'Tahorahi. Oh, sorry. My bad. Of Asher Yatzer. Of Asher Yatzer. And Asher Yatzer, the bracha concludes, Rofecho Basar Umafli Lasos. You heal all flesh, and you do wondrous things. What's a wondrous thing? Says the Ramah, and Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah of Moshe Israel says that you link a body and a soul together. And that's a Pella, and that's a wonder. The idea of wonder, right? If you see the amount of times, how many times it says wonder on this page. I had a good 15 or so times on this one page. In the writings of Rav Aharon Halevi, the concept of Pella comes up again and again and again, of this experience, this meditative experience of being able to sense two opposites in the same place. Mafli lasos, you can join a body and a soul together. A body is fleshig, right? And it's, as they would say in modern yeshiva speak, gashmius, right? And a soul is, as people would say, ruchnius, spirituality. And it would sound that they'd be two opposites. But mafli lasos, he does wonders. What does wonders mean? That we conjoin a body and a soul together. That's a wonder. That's a pella. This experience of understanding to have two total opposites residing in the same place. Sound familiar? Sounds almost DBT-ish, right? To have two opposites together, to have impossibilities, because as we said, the idea of having a feeling which is so strong that you can't consider another possibility. Suddenly, mafli lasos, what's a pella? To experience more than one at once. Wow, what a pella. A pella is the ability to experience more than one. So we don't have time to go into the whole thing, but if you look, I even tweeted, I have a number of secondary sources on the works of Rav Aharon Halevi, and they really did not mention this concept of pella, which, as you can see, he's quite fond of. And in these two books, I did not find anything about it. Maybe a little comment here, a little comment there. I'm like, this is not sufficient. So, but we see on that first page how many times it says the word pella. The second page is, you might have heard of the Chabad celebration of the 19th of Kislev, Yutes Kislev. So this is part of a drasha that Rav Aharon gave on the 19th of Kislev, because it was his Rebbe, the Baal Tanya, who was set free from a Russian prison. And he's talking about this idea of mafli lasos, of this wonder, this unbelievable wonder. What's the biggest wonder? That you can have one God and at the same time so many details, so many pieces fall into place. A transcendent God that interacts with us over here. And moreover, a transcendent Kadosh Baruch who wants the Dirasu B'Sachtonim, who wants to have a presence in this world, wants us to have a presence in this world for godliness. Godliness in this world? That sounds like a contradiction. Ah, that's a pella. That's a pella. That's getting us, again, away from extreme thinking to a dialectical thinking, that you can do both. And that's what Kadosh Baruch Hu wants, is that there should be both. That there should be spirituality within the physical world. Spirituality within the physical. So this concept is a pella. This is a wonder. So that's part of the brach of Asher Yatzar. That's the celebration of the Baal Tanya, and the celebration of the teaching of Chassidus also. We see this is in the first generation, by the way, right when the Tanya came from prison. It isn't just now that we accorded meaning to it. They say, oh, he went free. That must mean that there is this permission to divulge secrets of Torah in this way. No, this was the entire point. In this place, at this time, that such a great God, you know, transcendent God, wanted a presence in this world, and more of a presence in this world, more of a revealed presence in this world. We think Gashmias and Ruchnias, they're opposites. No, they meet in the same place. Yes.
Does the fact that we have this kind of remez to BPD and a bracha that really involves physical health, is that kind of a remez to the link between physical health and mental health?
It definitely could be. Remember, so the against the Ramah, the Ran the Ramah says this idea of is that so much. And I mean, nowadays we understand what with neuroplasticity, and that our thoughts literally change the biology of our bodies. So it's absolutely mafilasos that the shakings of the neshama, right, the thoughts that we have, right, the emanations from the neshama, you know, and how we look at thoughts. I'm sure we'll have a chance to speak about it more together, Mitzvah Hashem. But really do impact in the biology of the body. But this idea of joining this together, of having so many possibilities, and yet all coming from one God, from many one. So it's really, really fantastic. If anyone wants, I translated this mimer into English now, thinking about it now, that just message me on the chat or whatever, and I'll post a PDF of it. And then there's a little bit of translation from on a book about Rav Aaron called Seeker of Unity. It touches on the same idea, and this is the one quote in this book that I could find on Pell. It wasn't even in the index. I had to go through the entire thing to find the one point where he says the word Pell. If you look on page 127 in the parentheses. So he says that just as the power and might of a human king is seen as a greater effect when he succeeds in imposing his rules even on distant isles and by the most intensive warfare, so too the whole purpose of the existence of evil is for God's glory to be revealed even in its direct opposite. Not that the illusion illustration is exact. There cannot be anything in reality opposed to God. The existence of evil, the opposite of God's goodness, belongs to the great mystery as part of the greater mystery of how there could be a finite world at all. The illustration is intended only to convey that a full and complete revelation must proceed from the contrary of that which is revealed. In that same way, like we said, making room for that contradiction, that paradox, that dialectic, that's where healing comes from also. Is that for this reason that man's rejection of sin is so significant, and is the way that the very contrary to God is pressed into his service. This too is the mystery of the emergence of the loftiest souls from evil. Avram was Terach's son, David was descended through Ruth from Moab, Rabbi Kiva was from Sisera, and so forth. God's purpose in fulfilled in two ways. Firstly, Israel's worship, the unification of God, takes place. Secondly, God's glory is revealed even greater measure when the good vanquishes the powers of evil. This explains the otherwise puzzling statement in Lurianic Kabbalah that the spiritual root of Paro was nourished from the back of Kesser. Paro is a symbol of evil. How could it be that he reserves nourishment from the divine will? But it is the divine will that the glory of God be revealed by contrasting it to the contrary. This idea, again, is a Pella. The Pella means it comes from having two opposites in one place, being able to stand the two opposites, to have the dialectic. That dialectic and the contrast of that dialectic and the holding of that dialectic, that is a Pella. That's a wonder. And it's contemplation and meditation on this Pella. This is part of what Rav Aaron Halevi, you know, speaks about, like I said, in great detail. Like I said, only count the amount of times it showed up on that first page from one of his other books. Right? It's 15 times on one page. The word, this is Pella. This is a Pella. This is a Pella. Right? And he's not like, you know, like sounding like one of those, you know, little paperback Breslov books that, you know, they hand out in pizza stores, right? Whereas like, achi, yididi, achi, yididi, yididi, yididi. It's not like one of those that are repeating. Each line is adding a level of depth in one of Rav Aaron's farm. like rattling off shas and you know and gemaras and midrashim and zayers and the Ari, and then he's saying this is an aspect of the idea of Pella, the Pella, the great wonder. This is what I wanted to come to explain to you today. A little bit of the taste of DBT. And there's a lot more in this world, this fantastic world of DBT. As it was, we could have dove into an entire idea in Ishbitz, the Rambam, and Radzin, also with that idea of the Shvil HaZahav, of the middle way. But I wanted to talk about the dialectical portion of dialectical behavioral therapy, that being able to set up the opposite, and being able to see off of the opposite, and then see in terms of Chassidus, where we see how the contrast of seeing these two opposites in one place also allows, you know, for great unity to be revealed, and a great wonder, which is the Pella. Shkoyach for coming.